strike yet, but I will say a strike is not off the table, nor are informational pickets, mobilizing community members and faith leaders. You know, it's all of the above for us. I think what's important for me is that our members are the ones that are driving that. Well, we're sort of providing the options and structure to help them achieve the goals that they have. And then the last thing I'll say is, I don't think educators should be afraid to strike. You know, I look to the Chicago Teachers Union and our comrades in California. They really show us that it is often in our students' interests to strike, that if we want to secure high wages and quality, you know, learning conditions for our students, strikes are part of how we as working class people achieve that. And that's definitely something that is not lost on us. And we hope that our administration and Board of Education understand that too, that we are serious about getting organized and not making empty threats. But when we flex our muscle, we want them to know that it's a real, real possibility.
Fantastic. Well, how can our listeners help and keep in touch with your struggle?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I think continue to be on the lookout for announcements for future mobilizations, community mobilizations, that sort of thing. We're such a small union, we currently don't have a huge social media presence that I can direct you towards. But I would say just folks that are especially already involved in the labor movement, just keep your ears out. And then honestly, I think the best thing any working class person can be doing to help us is to be getting your own workplace organized, to be getting your own school organized, to be getting your own union in fighting shape. That's really what I see that our project is. We're getting our union into fighting shape. And the more you're able to fight where you're at, the stronger our fight's going to be where we're at. I think rebuilding lessons of solidarity in the union movement here in the metro area and all over is really important. So, you know, if you're going to a Starbucks sip-in, you're supporting Clackamas teachers that are organizing. If you're standing with UPS workers who might be striking next year, you're supporting our organizing. It's one struggle, one fight, all that good stuff.
Great. Any last thoughts, Mary Jean?
Well, I want to thank you very much for asking us onto this show and giving us a place to talk about our struggles and our goals. As Christopher said, Clackamas Associate Faculty is a small union, a small organization, and we've been trampled on a lot in the last decade. And I think we're coming into our own. And being part of a larger labor movement has been super empowering. And I want to echo what Christopher said. One of the best ways to support our cause is to join your union and to organize your workplace and support each other in the struggle to have a decent life as working people.
Great.
The last thing I'll say is,
you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Today, we're here with Betty Davis and Ralph Pointer with New Abolitionist Movement, among many other movements and projects and organizations and committees. And so honored to have you on the show. Finally, it's about time. How are y'all doing?
Well, we're fine, and we always look to what's happening in Portland because you seem to be a step or two ahead of the progressive movement in America. And as a result of being a step or two ahead, there seems to be a lot of harassment out there in Oregon by the government, by the Army of Occupation there in Oregon. Yes, we're fine, and hope you're doing the same.
Well, we appreciate that we have good friends and comrades like y'all on the East Coast in New York State and in the city doing all your amazing work and fighting the school to prison pipeline and fighting for the liberation of political prisoners, among many other things that you do. But those are definitely certain things we definitely wanted to talk about today. And first off, maybe saying something about some of the organizations and projects, how you all got involved with things like that.
Yes, well, we got started as teachers. I started teaching in New York City in 1962. I had taught 5 years in Pittsburgh, and I had considered going to Portland. I had received a position that I applied for in Portland, and that was the time when the first blacks and the migrant workers out in Portland were getting a population in the public schools, and they were looking for minority teachers, black and Latino teachers, to come to Portland, and they were so interested. And I met some of the people 20 years later who had come upon a plan to import teachers who were interested in educating, interested and had experience in working in the inner city and were successful at it. And they were motivators of this program. And so much so that they sent me pictures of a home to buy. It was a beach home. I guess it was on the Columbia River. And it was a fix-me-upper. And I had signed a contract and everything, but I decided I had been to New York as a sophomore in college, and I said, I got to see that town one more time. And of course, when I got to New York, that was it. I got a job teaching here, and I came face to face with the reality of colonialism and in all of its permutations. And they're all in the public school. And as a person who was interested in political activity, I went to the meetings of the Communist Party because I was at the very end of the Black Renaissance. And we had read so much about that. And the great James Baldwin, the great actors, they were here. And I just wanted to get a taste of that life. And I plugged into that instantly. But I found out instantly that I was to the left of the Communist Party. Because one of the things, you know, like you read a book and you're involved in political struggle. And in the early meetings, I had said, one of the things we must do is deal with the class and race question within the black community. And the party said it was too soon. And to me, that was insanity. You know, how are you gonna call yourself a communist and not deal with class and race? And when they felt it was a little wrong, I felt I was wasting my time. And I had met Lynn Stewart at the time. She was a librarian. And she says, why do you argue with these people? Start your own organization. And that's what we did. This was 1962, and the organization was Teachers Freedom Party. And we organized progressive teachers. We organized with progressive teachers. We organized with the Communist Party, which was within the UFT, United Federation of Teachers, was just getting started. And so we were early members. We were organizers, the original organizers of the UFT. And then we realized that they were a racist organization. And then we fought within the UFT to change it. And that was our organization, Teachers Freedom Party. And that was a caucus within the United Federation of Teachers. But we put a different spin on it. What we did was we organized with parents in order to have power. We felt we would have no power just as a teachers group. And when we organized with parents, we were getting the teeth into our organization because we were both looking for education of the inner city children. And during this struggle, a group of progressives came to me and they says, Ralph, we want you to become a part of the anti-prison industrial complex. And I said to him, that's what I'm doing. When you educate black children in the public schools, then you're fighting the prison industrial complex. And we were opposed to prisons. I don't know if you're familiar with the setup in New York City, but the black communities are separate. Large black community in the city called Harlem. Large black community in Brooklyn called Bed-Stuy. Large black and brown community in the Bronx. This is where the students went from the projects to the public schools to the prison pipeline. And we felt we could interdict that if we had community control. And what we meant by community control is just the same democracy that was supposedly enjoyed by white communities. They picked the educators, they picked what was to be, what education looked like in their community, they hired everybody, they purchased the books, tables, they determined who was to build the buildings, they determined who was to be employed in the buildings, and that was democracy, public education. We just wanted that for the black community. And it was obvious that we had 32 districts, and each district was larger than most white communities. And so we said, we'll just duplicate that form and, you know, educate within the black community. Not to say that the education was going to be different, but it would be different if you can imagine the books. There was no black history at the time. We did our own books. And the big thing, the big issue was economics. If you control your education budget, and New York City has an education budget larger than most countries in the world, and if you decided or determined that when you had your contract to buy desks, not books, just desks, and you could ask somebody who you were buying these desks from whether they had fair employment laws, and that you could run this right through the education budget. The procurement budget in New York City is $6 billion the last time I checked, and I'm sure it's more than that.
$36 billion.
No, the procurement, just buying of things. Oh. And you see, Sister Betty's listening. And so what we have here is an opportunity for justice and control of one's own education system. Now we go to that education system, which we're still having the battle today. They do not want to have the truth of America. We had black history, which is nonsense. There's no black history. There's no white history. There's only history. What happened? And the history of people of color, basically Africans in America, and indigenous people in America, is so horrific, even when I hear it, it chills the skin, raises hairs on your arms, because it has been a terrible situation. But if we're to ever come to any truth, we have to deal with the past truth. We have to deal with the truth of the indigenous people here. We have to deal with the truth of religion. What role they played, what role the Pope played, what role the Pope played with imperialism. I believe we can get over it, because I personally feel I'm not going to talk about reparations, although we know that we deserve reparations. We're the only people on the planet who didn't get reparations for, no, I won't go that far. We're some of the people on the planet. There are other people who have been done evil and they haven't had reparations, but we are a large number of people, and our combined strength should be able to force that. For example, many years ago, I believe it was around 1965, Dr. Nathan Hare of Howard University in Washington had a meeting to decide how much money was owed the descendants of Africans, enslaved Africans, at one penny a day and no interest. It was a tremendous, I believe it was some like 200 some thousand dollars for every black man, woman, and child who could prove descendancy from African slavery. While I take exception to that, I want 10 cents a day in interest. So you see the issue there. But
well,
I say,
let's go back to the issue of the Lynn Stewart organization and the new abolitionist movement and how it interjects or intersects with the whole concept of prison education, prison pipeline, or the whole incarceration issue.
I like to deal with it in terms of colonialism. It's just one example. It's the same colonialism applied to every situation.
But why so many, one out of every eight Black people as of 1985 are incarcerated? We have more people incarcerated now than we had in slavery at the inception of slavery on this particular continent. I think this is what Adam is trying to address and how we attack it. Am I in the right path here?
I would say anytime you want to destroy a community, take their jobs, take their education, then they will fend for themselves, and the only thing left to them is illicit trades.
Well, that's the overt answer, but the direct answer is the man who was on 60 Minutes last night in 1984 was responsible for legislation that escalated the incarceration of a whole nation within a nation. Queen Mother Moore said, "We are Africans held captive in America." We did not have a plebiscite to say, can you go home, or do you want to stay, or did you want to come? Unlike the people who are escaping from the oppression of the evil empire abroad, we were forced to come here. And we never had reparations for that. I think this is what Ralph is talking about. But within the context of the slavery, it just morphed from object shackle slavery into the slavery of the chain gangs and the building of the levees and things like that, the infrastructure of America. A modern day example of that slavery is Louisiana, where they have thousands in prison who were convicted without a 12-member jury and 25 corporations.
Let me interrupt it. They had a 12-member jury, but it only took 9 guilty votes to find them guilty. And in the American Constitution, slavery was abolished except for those who were found guilty of crimes.
It was a continuation.
It was a continuation of slavery in another name. Now, there's a book written on it. There's several books. And slavery in another name continued up till the 1930s in America.
I just want to interject about Biden. He's up there talking about he's giving a break on the college debt. But Biden, along with the duplicity of the Black Congressional Caucus in the 80s, were responsible for the crack cocaine legislation, which was the continuation of what Reagan said he was going to do. We'll put them in jail and we'll blame the drug thing on them and lock them all up. And that's how we'll kill the movement of the 60s. Those are Reagan's words. So Biden is just the continuation of a Republican, showing there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. This system that we're in is based on slavery. It's modern slavery and old slavery. And it's the same corporations that run it. The Dutch East India Corporation or company was responsible for the first slaves coming here. And there are millions of people involved in corporations today that are responsible for the slavery in all of the prisons. If they cut out the prison labor in America and had to pay the workers in the prisons what they are supposed to pay the workers on the outside, America could not exist. So part of your incarceration is definitely based on capitalism and colonialism.
Well, the history of American capitalism was based on slavery, and we still have it, but with various names.
Yes.
For example, they used to have, and I find the most outrageous of the laws to keep people enslaved, was the crime of vagrancy.
Yes.
Just being there, you could go to jail. And then they played with that in all kind of vicious ways, and they just had slavery all over again. And the need for roads in the south, of the southern part of America, well, they had an answer for that. Just gather up these people, convict them of crimes, like I say, vagrancy, and you had a system or you had a labor force. And so America has continued this. And just changing the name, changing how it was done. And as Betty mentioned, the most recent was, you know, like the crack cocaine. But unjust laws, unjust courts. When we talk about justice, and I talk about terrorism, every black person knows of terrorism, because when any situation where a person of color has to go to court, there's fear, because we know we're not going to get just treatment in the courts. If there is racism in America, then when you go to court, you're going to see racist judges. You're going to have racist laws, or laws will apply to you in a different way. And so it has been a continuation of colonialism with a different name. Now, we feel that education was a basic way. When they make pretend to say that you can children can get educated, if we could have an education system that was guided by the same laws, an education system in the black community that was guided by the same laws as the education system in the white community, we could have a fantastic education system. And when I say a black education system, I have always said, when people ask the question, you mean you want separation? And I'm saying, no, we are here. And back in the 60s, I said, it is obvious that in America, the education system that was once a very fine education system was on the way down. And if we were able to control our own education system in our inner cities, we would have a fine education system, and white students would want to come into our education system, and we would say fine, because we are about education for all. But we were figuring, how do we interdict that? We can't go to the white communities and talk about the education system. They never wanted us in their education system, not even children. And so we say, what do we have? We have inner cities. Let us control the education system, the education itself, and the budget, which is most important, and have jobs in our community. And if people do transgress the law, we want to build the prisons in our communities. But they had a whole system. They built the prisons outside of our communities, charged the prices of the bus going to the prison, the routes, all of the prices went up, the phone calls coming from the prison, and it was, they separated people from their families, and they had a prison budget, which was developed for other communities. If we had a prison budget within our community, that would add to the education budget. So you see, it's just colonialism, slavery with new names, new tactics, and we want to interdict that.
One of the things I was aware of is Comrade Jaleel Montequin sent out an article which dealt with the nexus of the prisons in different communities. And it showed how wherever you have the prisons, you have corporations, you have increased police and military interdiction into the oppressed communities around that prison system. The point I'm making is, when the colonialists came to America, they set up these forts. And within these forts, they moved out and preyed upon the First Nations that are here. And in effect, this model is the same model America is still using. The legislation that Biden and the Black Congressional Caucus passed in the 80s was devastating to the Black and Brown communities. And then the emergence of a civil rights struggle, which morphed into a human rights struggle, because it was obvious they were never going to give up the right to keep people from voting of color. If it wasn't for the Panthers, that never would have happened. The Panthers were the answer to the bombings and the lynchings and the beatings of the people who were organizing. And out of that came the 1965 legislation. And as Jesse Jackson said, that airplane had long wings. Women's rights came in on that. The rights of immigrants came in on that plane. The whole civil rights era brought in the democratization of America off the backs of people who are in the death camps today.
Attempted democratization.
Yes.
We are still
But what I want to say is when we fail to organize the education system around a model of community control, not just decentralization, because we in effect had decentralization, we ended up with 32 districts, and that's decentralization because the districts were under the auspices of the state. The state appointed the superintendents through the mayor and the governor and the Democratic Party. So that decentralization was still colonialism. And that's why when the communists in the 50s and 60s critiqued anybody Black who said, we're not all Black together. There is a class and race struggle going on within our community. They killed our movement because you end up with people like the guy who just died, Lewis, that everybody loves, who was the biggest apologist for colonialism that you can imagine. And you had these what I call, or what Glenn Ford called, Black misleadership class traitors throughout the community. And the reason the Lynn Stewart organization and the new abolitionist movement were unique from my perspective is they said, we will join with anyone. We don't have to have our own organization. We will join yours and we will share with your organization what was successful in another organization so that we can bring about the unity on any particular action to make that action effective. It's like guerrilla warfare through organizing. It was organizing using the guerrilla warfare tactics. You strike and move. If there's something out here, you go there, you support it, and all the organizations that you've worked with, you say, hey, come over here, join this, do this. That's what made new abolitionist movement a little different. And it sure made Lynn Stewart organization different because she didn't just want to help white political prisoners. When she was first incarcerated, people were very upset because she included Black political prisoners in her literature. And she told Ralph, don't do anything for me that you don't do for the Black political prisoners and vice versa. We support Mamiya, but we also support Assange. And yes, if we don't do this, we're going to lose. It's as simple as that. We're going
to
lose.
Very well said, Sister Betty. We have to support. And emotionally, it's not a problem for us. We support people of justice who support just causes. The idea, it's one of the things that amazes me that the so-called progressive people are not supporting Julian Assange. He is us. He gave us the information to act upon. How is it that Snowden had sense? He looked at it and says, I'm out of here. He told the truth. And so we have our work cut out for us. And we feel that education was the way to start because everyone has input into education. They got a niece, a nephew, a cousin, a brother, a sister. This is the heart of the community. The education budget is the heart of the economy of the community.
It also gives you a foothold into the community because when you participate in a PTA, that's as local as government's going to get. If you cannot get to the parents to help them understand the issues that are in their self-interest, I forget which one of the political leaders says, let's not forget the people are in the struggle for housing, for bread, a roof over their heads and bread and a job. They're not in this for all this theory that we talk. You can say colony all you want, but unless you can concretize them into their everyday struggles, it does not connect for them to act.
And we concretize it into their everyday struggle with a job, control of a budget. It has to come down to the local level. And we have found the problem has been, I think one of the things that many people on the left say, the death of a movement is joining the Democratic Party. And we say, what has happened? We have that other problem. That is the problem of the class problem within the Black community.
I'd like to rephrase what Brother Ralph said. I think it was the Democratic Party is where all progressive ideas go to die.
Okay, that was very well stated. And so... But, you know, we can't blame it all on other people. We have to look at ourselves because the class and color struggle within the Black community was amplified very clearly in Louisiana, where the laws in Louisiana weren't as restrictive to brown people as opposed to black people. And when they were able to institutionalize that within the black community, or to have it accepted within the black community without analysis of what that meant, that was just another split in the communities. I remember in South Africa when the ANC was fighting for their liberation against the apartheid system, they decided to copy the Americans, and they went, that is the apartheid system, Verwoerd and names like that, went to the Indians and says, we're going to have different laws for brown people as opposed to the extremely oppressive laws to black people. And so when the Indians went to the ANC and says, what do you think about that? The ANC had the right answer and said, if you go for that, you're the enemy too. We will fight you. And so the Indians and the brown people said, no, we're not going to go for that. But in America, it was a success, and it still is real in Louisiana. Well, it's real within our community. Light-skinned people, I don't know if you ever noticed it, but if you notice, light-skinned people seem to be together. I say, how can that be in a society where there's a mix? You go to work and you're mixed with all kinds of people. And white people are mixing with black people to a degree. But within the black community, you find most light-skinned people marry light-skinned people. We see the Obamas. They seem to be the epitome of a success within the black community. They didn't do anything for the black community, but then many people within the black community aspire to be that. That is, colonialism has a structure to it. We oppose the false policies of integration. We said there's no